a surprise Nobel Peace Prize win, today, Friday, October 11th. And this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons wins this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Wait, who?
These are nameless heroes, for the most part, who are now finally getting some wonderful recognition from the Nobel Committee.
The OPCW is busy working in Syria right now, destroying chemical weapons, but some Syrians think those weapons are not their biggest concern.
So it's going to take 9 months to hand over the chemical weapons. But no one is talking about how these 9 months will be continuous suffering for Syrians about to face the winter.
Also, the Somali-American who pointed a gun at Tom Hanks.
I had no choice.
It was all in a day's work on the set of the new piracy movie, Captain Phillips.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, this is The World.
The Nobel Peace Prize should have gone to her because she had the courage to stand up and say, if you're going to hit me with whatever you've got. I'm going to stand tall.
So Pakistani girl activist Malala Yousafzai didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize, but she's still inspiring young women around the world. We'll hear from some of them later in the show. But first, let's take a look at the group that did win the Peace Prize today. The United Nations Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. It was recognized for its efforts to eliminate chemical weapons, including Syria's stockpiles of nerve gas. Until recently, the OPCW has gotten little attention, so we're going to turn to Amy Smithson. She's a chemical and biological weapons expert at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Washington. Amy, give me a snapshot of how the OPCW goes about its work.
Well, first of all, prior to this day and to the chemical crisis in Syria, they've gone about their work very, very quietly, with very few people paying attention. The treaty that bans chemical weapons provides inspection rights for this organization, and they literally trot the globe, going to military facilities where chemical weapons are stored and overseeing the destruction of chemical arsenals. They've done this in India, in South Korea, in Albania. They continue to do this in Libya, in the United States, and in Russia. And in addition to that type of inspection, they also inspect chemical industry facilities. The chemical industry makes a lot of chemicals that are used for legitimate purposes. But if these chemicals were diverted into a military program and that's what they safeguard against, then we would have chemical weapons proliferation. So they do two types of inspections, military and commercial facilities.
Are there countries out there that one suspects has chemical weapons, but they're just not playing ball, they're not signing on to the treaty, and therefore their weapons aren't getting inspected or removed?
Well, at the top of that list, one would find North Korea. That probably doesn't surprise your listeners because North Korea is known best for its nuclear weapons program, but they're also thought to be harboring a biological and definitely a chemical weapons capability. Other countries that I would hope would soon join the Chemical Weapons Convention would be Egypt, which at one time was thought to be a chemical weapons possessor, and Israel, which is in kind of a limbo status. They've signed the treaty but not ratified it. And perhaps the joining of Syria, and if the chemical disarmament process does go smoothly there, we'll see these other Middle Eastern nations join the treaty.
And who are the people who actually carry out the work of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons?
Yeah, these are nameless heroes, for the most part, who are now finally getting some wonderful recognition from the Nobel Committee. They're chemical analysts and engineers, in some cases weapons experts. The inspectors can come from any of the states that belong to the treaty, and now there are 190 members, although something tells me they're not going to be asking the Syrians to be inspectors anytime soon.
Now that the OPCW has received this Peace Prize, do you think it will enhance or possibly hinder their effectiveness?
Well, one would hope that it would be an enhancement. First of all, they badly need the cash that comes along with the prize. And the situation in Syria is going to put an incredible burden on the very meager resources that the OPCW has to do its work around the world. They have roughly 110 inspectors, and they have to be able to send a lot of these people into Syria on very short notice and still do their work around the world, which is why there are plans underway to augment the manpower of this organization. Another thing that I hope that the Nobel recognition does is help the international community understand that while the nuclear weapons threat is something they should be concerned about, let's not forget that chemical weapons, which were the first weapon of mass destruction to be used on World War I battlefields, they took thousands and thousands of lives. That this is something that also needs attention and resources devoted to address this problem.
Amy Smithson is an expert in chemical and biological weapons at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thanks.
It may come as a surprise to some, but the Syrian government is doing what it said it would when it comes to chemical weapons. That's according to OPCW Director Ahmet Uzumcu.
The cooperation has been quite constructive, and I would say that the Syrian authorities have been cooperative. They have started to contribute to a trust fund that we have established, and I welcome all this.
But as reporter Rasha Ilaz reports from Syria, the OPCW's assessment is little comfort to residents of one Damascus neighborhood called Zamalka. It's one of the spots where the government of Bashar al-Assad is said to have used chemical weapons.
There are endless blocks of fallen concrete and twisted metal, buildings that are sliced in half, remnants of lives that used to be. A washing machine, the headboard of a king-size bed, pieces of a toilet. People here say what the weapons inspectors do or don't do matters little to them. 16-year-old Mohammed Al-Zeba walks through the rubble. He lost his entire family the night of the chemical attack. He names each family member in a soft but matter-of-fact voice. Among them, his mother and father. His five brothers and sisters, two aunts, two uncles, and all of their children. After the sarin gas rockets struck, which everyone here blames on the government, Mohammed says he and a friend tended to dozens of the injured. Now there are major food and medicine shortages in Zamalka. Government checkpoints prevent even bread from coming in, and most residents can't leave the besieged area because government troops would detain them for being rebels or rebel sympathizers. So people here ask, if the UN can get Assad to give up his chemical weapons, then why not pressure him to stop starving us? Abdel Nasser Shamir is the head of the rebel military council in Zamalka.
So it's going to take 9 months to hand over the chemical weapons. But no one is talking about how these 9 months will be continuous suffering for Syrians about to face the winter, or the 3 million refugees still outside Syria, or how most rebel-held areas are under siege, or the serious shortage of food and medicine. They're just talking about the chemical weapons, not about the 10 or 15 million Syrians who are suffering.
In the evening, men hang out together in someone's home. You can hear gunfire from the front line, barely a five-minute drive away. The men are silent. They check their computers for the latest news from rebel brigades. They listen to favorite songs about war, about mothers of fallen soldiers. The chorus repeats, "We remain steadfast here amid all the rubble." For the world, I'm Rasha Ilaz, Damascus, Syria.
Human Rights Watch has documented several instances where pro-Assad forces have committed atrocities in Syria. Now the group says that jihadist rebels are also guilty of war crimes there. It conducted an investigation into killings that took place during the early morning hours of August 4th in villages in northern Syria, and the findings are pretty grim. Peter Buchard is the Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me earlier from Geneva.
What we found is that a group of mostly hardcore Islamist fighting groups went into this Alawite area where most of the people are with the Assad regime. And as they captured the villages, they killed as many as 190 people, including many women and children. Many of these killings were pure executions. And they also took 200 people hostages. Those people are still missing since the beginning of August. They have not been released, and we're very concerned about their fate.
What do the Syrian rebels there say took place? Do they deny this completely, or is there a dialogue going on about what really happened?
I think there's very little doubt about what happened. Following the release of our report, the Syrian National Council, as well as the Free Syrian Army, acknowledged that very serious abuses took place. They distanced themselves from the groups who were responsible. But that's exactly what we're concerned about, that there is a breakdown of control over many of these groups. They're fighting each other as well as against Assad. And some of the more extremist groups are starting to carry out these brutal massacres against perceived government supporters, basically on a sectarian basis. From the videos they posted themselves, it was very clear that they were killing these civilians simply because they were Alawites.
Tell us a bit more about this part of northern Syria where these attacks in August took place. I'm trying to get at who's responsible for the killings and who the victims are in terms of, we hear a lot about different rebel groups. Who are these people and who are the victims?
Yes, so the coastal area of Latakia is inhabited mostly by Alawites. Actually, at the beginning of the century, it briefly was made an Alawite state led by the French government, the colonial powers. And many of these Alawites identify very closely with the Assad regime. And they also have very legitimate fears that if the Assad regime falls, that they will be massacred. The people who were responsible for these killings belong to jihadi groups, mostly Sunni jihadi groups, who consider the Alawites to be non-Muslim. They also considered Shia to be non-Muslim, and they killed these people mostly on sectarian basis because of their hatred of non-Sunni Muslims.
And are these rebels that you're describing, are they from the same area?
No, most of the members of the ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Shams, as well as of the group Al-Muhajirin, many of their fighters are foreigners. The Muhajirin is actually led by a Chechen, Abu Omar al-Checheni, and many of his fighters are from the Caucasus, as well as from North Africa.
Wow.
ISIS is the affiliate of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria, and also includes many mostly Arab foreign fighters.
So what does this mean for the U.S. and other Western nations? They really want to support the Syrian rebels. They don't like Assad. But then the people they want to support are then committing atrocities.
Well, this obviously is a horrific nightmare for the Syrian people. They are now stuck between a regime which has brutally bombed their towns and villages across the country and has been implicated in so many massacres and chemical weapons attacks, and extremist groups which are imposing a different kind of brutal rule on them. It's important that the West tries to do what they can, as well as the backers of these groups.
Peter Buchart is the Emergencies Director at Human Rights Watch in Geneva. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick update now on a story from a few weeks ago. You might remember our report on a legal challenge to France's ban on fracking for natural gas. France was the first country in the world to ban the controversial drilling technique. That was 2 years ago. But an American energy company argued the ban was unconstitutional. Well, today France's constitutional court upheld the fracking ban. The country's ecology and energy minister said the ruling was a victory for the environment. And it means that at least for now, France will stay out of the global natural gas rush. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In a natural disaster, little is more important than medical care. But when a massive earthquake or storm injures large numbers of people, Health systems are often crippled, too. Sherry Fink is a doctor and journalist who's written about practicing medicine in emergencies around the globe. She has a new book out. It's called 5 Days at Memorial. Sherry Fink, it's so great to have you back on our show.
It's great to be back.
Now, the title of your book refers to Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans and the very infamous and awful events that happened there in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Now, why did you decide to tell this story?
Part of it was that I had never heard outside of the realm of, you know, fiction or movies of things becoming so desperate that doctors and nurses actually thought or discussed or possibly did hasten the deaths of their patients in a desperate circumstance. And that very quickly after Hurricane Katrina, there were stories that this may have happened in this one hospital, Memorial Medical Center. And so I thought that it was something that we in the U.S. found that we were stunningly unprepared for here.
What about a situation, say, in Haiti? You've done reporting there that could be compared in some ways more directly to Katrina because it was a natural disaster, you know, the earthquake. What sort of choices were they making there? Was it a seat of the pants or had there been thinking about what to do?
A lot of countries kind of came into Haiti and tried to help and set up these field hospitals, and they faced exactly this situation that the doctors and nurses in Katrina faced, which is having to make some difficult decisions. In Haiti, it was that there was, you know, there were so many injured people and there were very few medical facilities that could really treat them. And for the world, we did the story about some of the very difficult decisions that came up at an American field hospital. And at the time, they were trying to figure out how to triage people, and they decided that they would try to use their resources to help people who they might be able to quickly help.
And interestingly, we have something from the piece you did for us, which sort of illustrates that point, and then we can talk about it right after. And this is what a nurse named Patrick Cadillac told you in Haiti.
We're running out of oxygen. We don't have any logistics support to be able to provide us oxygen. I only have so many people that I can treat, and I have to make a decision about what this resource is going to be used and how it's going to be used.
What kind of decisions did he make?
So he decided to save it for the operating room for people who had broken limbs, et cetera, and they had a surgical team come in and try to provide surgery for these patients. And there was a particular patient we followed who was triaged in the situation. And Patrick Cadillac said that, you know, she could need to use oxygen indefinitely. And so he decided that he would take away the oxygen from her. And he called it essentially a death sentence for her.
That's tough. That's the patient you follow quite closely, Nathalie Lebrun. By Patrick Cadillac, the nurse acknowledging that it was basically a death sentence, what did happen to Nathalie Lebrun?
Well, she was sent to a partially destroyed Haitian hospital where it was known that there was no oxygen there. But when she arrived, it turned out that a bit of oxygen was found for her, and she was able to survive.
How long did she live?
She lived, well, she actually came to the U.S. for treatment, and unfortunately, it was found when she got here that she needed a lung transplant, and she died before she could get one. Mm. But she was very excited to see the U.S., and when she came to the American hospital, she couldn't believe how she was being treated. You know, for her, being in an American hospital was like what we would imagine, like going to a spa, you know. And here we feel like, obviously, we hate to be in the hospital and it's this awful thing.
We complain about the food.
Yeah, she was just so delighted. And just the fact that a nurse would come in and ask her, is there something I can do for you? Are you comfortable? In Haiti, I think, and this happens sometimes in disasters, is like, you know, as a healthcare professional, it's so hard when you don't have the tools to help people.
What draws you to this subject?
When I was in my last year of medical school, I had been in touch with some Bosnian medical students at the time, and the war in Bosnia had just finished. And I went over, they had a conference about, I think it was called Medicine, War, and Peace. And I went to this conference, and I was amazed because here I was in an American medical school, and I felt like the things I was learning about that they had faced in a crisis were just extensions of the same kinds of ethical dilemmas that we face every day in American medicine. So I felt like, and I still feel, that situations of disaster or war or conflict, sometimes these emergency situations, can crystallize issues, can help us see issues that are really with us all the time.
Sherry Fink is a doctor and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's reported for The World and ProPublica and other outlets. Her new book is 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. Thanks so much for stopping by, Sherry.
Thanks.
And you can hear Sherry Fink's report from Haiti, the one we were just talking about. It originally aired in 2010. You'll find it at PRI.org. Now, getting back to Malala Yousafzai, the 16-year-old Pakistani girl who's become a global advocate for girls' education, she was shot by the Taliban for being so outspoken. Like many, we thought she'd get the Nobel Prize today. But we wondered what schoolgirls around the world know about Malala. So we asked our reporter Anders Kelto to stop by the high school in Cape Town, South Africa that he's been profiling this year.
When I got to the school, I found ninth grader Owetu sitting outside. She's a bit of a bookworm and likes to start debates with me, often about U.S. foreign policy. I walked up to her.
So Malala was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Just came out today, and she didn't win. Any reaction?
The Nobel Peace Prize should have gone to her because she didn't use violence. She had the courage to stand up and say, if you're going to hit me with whatever you've got.
She said Malala's story has inspired young women here in South Africa.
She has taught a lot of women outside that you should stand up for yourself. Make sure that people don't think of you as little. They should think of you as someone who is important and who has a role in society.
Some of Owetu's friends joined her. I thought I'd broaden the conversation.
Do you feel like girls in South Africa are treated unequally compared to boys?
Yes. For example, if you're a girl and you get pregnant, your parents kick you out. But if you're a boy and you got a girl pregnant, your parents reward you for getting a girl pregnant.
So they reward you?
Yeah. Mm. So for a lot of things...
Wait, how do they reward you?
Like they think they're going to have a grandson.
So they're excited about it because they're going to have another grandkid.
Yeah, a family name.
That's Cecile, a ninth grader. But getting back to Malala, I asked what the girls thought they could learn from her. That's when Owetu said something that surprised me. She said Malala was not only a champion of girls' rights.
She believes we should let people be equal, not judge them by race or by color or by sex. She has potential to be something very huge in the world. Like she has the power to change a lot of people's minds.
And she said Malala would continue to change people's minds about all forms of equality, even without the Nobel Peace Prize. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
This is The World on PRI.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A lawmaker from Syria's ruling party calls the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to the UN Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons a vindication for the Syrian government. President Assad has long claimed that Syrian rebels were the ones responsible for the gas attack on the outskirts of Damascus in August. He's even argued that it's easy for the rebels to make the lethal gas. Here's Assad in an interview on Fox News last month.
The sarin gas called the kitchen gas. Do you know why? Because anyone can make sarin in his house.
Dan Cazzetta is a former officer in the U.S. Army Chemical Corps. He's now an independent chemical defense consultant. We spoke to him earlier. Dan Cazzetta, how about it? How easy is it to make sarin?
First of all, it takes some fairly complicated chemical engineering procedures to do it because the ingredients, some of them are frankly more dangerous than the sarin itself in some ways. Sarin itself is not physically corrosive, but some of the things that you have to do to make sarin require things like hydrogen fluoride, which is one of the most corrosive and dangerous industrial substances on the planet. If you try to do it in your kitchen, you're probably going to kill yourself, and you're probably going to destroy your kitchen in the process because it requires high-temperature hydrogen fluoride.
Can you buy the ingredients for sarin on the market or on the web?
Generally speaking, you can get some of the raw materials, but not others. You have to use some of the raw materials to manufacture further, more sophisticated raw materials. It's not like you can get absolutely everything you need and order it and have it turn up. It's actually a long, convoluted process. It's not like basic kitchen cooking. You don't add part A and part B and get sarin. There's approximately 19, maybe 20, depending on who you ask, production pathways to produce sarin.
So it's not like Breaking Bad.
No, it's not. It's not methamphetamine. It's not even like making ricin out of castor beans or something like that. Let me put it in context for you. The one non-state actor that made any significant amount of sarin was the Aum Shinrikyo cult in Japan. And they actually spent millions of dollars, had over a dozen chemists and chemical engineers on their payroll, built a three-story laboratory with some very good, very complicated, expensive equipment bought through front companies. And they could make maybe about 8 liters of sarin. And that was after rather a lot of trial and development.
And they famously used sarin in the Tokyo subway in 1995. I think about 13 people died.
Yes.
In the case of making sarin, homemade sarin, is it primarily the difficulty in getting the ingredients or the explosive nature of them once you get them?
It's primarily the corrosive nature of some of the precursor chemicals and the fact that you have to do things like have high-temperature corrosive gases. I mean, it will literally eat you alive. It will corrode metal. It will corrode plastic. It will corrode glass. One of the ways I can describe this is the scientists that first developed the stuff, the IG Farben company in Germany, in Nazi Germany, they spent rather a lot of money putting in silver-lined plumbing to handle the stuff. The U.S. had a sarin production facility in Rocky Mountain Arsenal, 1953 to 1957, and producing sarin. They went to great lengths to safely handle the corrosive products and did all sorts of things remotely to handle the ingredients. And even then, they had incidents.
And is there any U.S. stockpile of sarin now?
There's a little bit left. I don't know the exact statistics. The U.S. is in the middle of a lengthy chemical demilitarization program, getting rid of its old Cold War stockpile.
Hypothetically, if you get your hands on some sarin, how long can you store it?
That's an interesting question. It depends on how well it's made. If you follow the basic process to make sarin, what you actually get is a cocktail of sarin and acids. Okay. The U.S. and the Soviet Union learned the dark art of refining the acid out at the last step. If you do that, add a few stabilizers, sarin can last 50 years. Some of the sarin that the U.S. military built made in 1957 when they took it out to destroy it was as good as the day it was made. But that's a result of many millions of dollars of research and development and a lot of PhD chemists and chemical engineers working on it. You get the other side of the equation. You look at, is sarin and the other nerve agents made by Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war? Saddam Hussein's stuff had shelf life of weeks, maybe months, because they couldn't refine the acid out.
Dan Cazzetta is a former officer in the U.S. Army Chemical Corps. He's written a piece for Bloomberg News called No, You Can't Make Sarin in Your Kitchen. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Egypt's not happy about the U.S. decision this week to freeze aid to the military-run government, especially now that it's facing an Islamist insurgency in the Sinai. That's the region that borders Gaza and Israel. The Egyptian army has launched a campaign there to root out what it calls terrorists. But civilians have also become targets.
What I found was pretty shocking. I found a lot of civilian homes coming under attack. I found that a woman had been killed, a child had been injured.
That's reporter Nadine Marushi. She recently visited northern Sinai and wrote about it for Slate magazine. I asked her to describe the Sinai and why it's such a critical area.
It's largely made up of vast swathes of desert land. It's very agricultural. There are olive farms everywhere, citrus farms. When you talk to people there, when you ask them, you know, what their source of livelihood is, they'll say farming, you know. And I went to Bedouins farms where they grow olives and clementines, etc. But also made up of hills.
Is it a generally poor area, poor part of Egypt?
Yes, very underdeveloped. It's one of the least developed areas in Egypt, especially compared to South Sinai. South Sinai is a beach and tourist haven for many people. A lot of people will be familiar with Sharm el-Sheikh, Deheb, where they go to these lavish hotels, diving. It's really built up, whereas North Sinai is very poor. In fact, large parts of, you know, parts of Arish looked like refugee camps that I had visited in Palestine.
And significantly, Sinai borders Gaza Strip and Israel, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. And that plays a huge part in the geopolitics, in the politics of the area, in what's going on there. You know, to understand what's going on in Sinai, you really need to understand the fact that Gaza is under siege, the fact that about 10% of the population of North Sinai are originally Palestinian, and the fact that Israel occupied the Sinai Peninsula for 15 years until the signing of the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel in 1979.
What spurred this recent military incursion into Sinai to rid it of militant elements? What was going on there?
Well, the army has been coming under increased, the army and police have been coming under increased attack since General Abdel Fattah Sisi ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi in July. At least 100 police and army officers have been killed since July 3rd, according to the military. And a large part of these attacks have come from Sinai-based militant groups.
What changed after the revolution in northern Sinai?
What changed is that whilst there was heavy police presence in North Sinai under Mubarak, and again, that was a large source of the tensions, heavy-handed security crackdowns, tortures, arrests under Mubarak. After the revolution, as the police force was defeated across a large part of the country, then, you know, people had had freedom to roam about, to move about within North Sinai. You know, a lot of Bedouins say how they couldn't even move between one town to the next under Mubarak, whereas now, or at least before this Sinai campaign, you can move about much more freely.
What's the attitude towards the Egyptian government at this point in North Sinai?
From the people that I spoke to, which, you know, I spent 3 nights and 4 days in two villages, Mahdiya and Muqata'a, and in Arish. These are villages and towns that are very close to the borders of Gaza and Israel. And I interviewed about 30 people. So across the spectrum, from people who supported the army to people who were sympathetic to the Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood, I didn't hear anyone say a good thing about the way the army was conducting this operation. Everyone was complaining about the level of unprofessionalism and violations. And people are afraid. People on the ground are really afraid because they're caught between two sides. The army that have air forces that can send bomb, that are bombing houses, and that have ground troops to burn and bomb houses. And then you've got militant groups who are threatening, who have sent out threats through their statements saying, if anyone sides with the army, we will kill them. People are kind of caught in between. They don't want to help the army in fear of the militants, and they don't want to help the militants in fear of the army. So many people were crying out for help, saying, who do we turn to? We have no one to turn to. The state is against us. And that was the feeling on the ground.
Nadine Marouchi is a freelance journalist. She's just back from Sinai. Nadine, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's a good day for the UN, with its chemical weapons inspectors getting honored with a Nobel Peace Prize. The UN has been recognized in other ways over the years. A Lego model of UN headquarters was recently unveiled. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon even snapped in the final piece on a large-scale version. We got the small kit here in the office, all 597 pieces. And the world's Nina Pourzoukhi is going to try to assemble it. But first, she has this story.
Since its completion in 1952, the flat, rectangular, modernist masterpiece on the East River, that is the United Nations headquarters, has been the site of much geopolitical intrigue, as well as the backdrop for films like North by Northwest. It even makes an appearance in Grand Theft Auto 4, the video game. But now, for the first time, you or I or anyone can put it together Lego brick by Lego brick. Why would Lego want to recreate the UN? For that, I turned to a Lego expert.
So how many Legos do you have, John?
I don't know, maybe 20,000?
John Batesdahl is the author of the book The Cult of Lego. And though the UN box set says it's for 12 and up, Lego's emphasis, says John, is on the up.
They create very large and sophisticated models for the benefit of these parents who grew up in the 70s with Lego of their own, and then they decided that, hey, I still like this. You know, they bought some for their kids, perhaps, and then they realized they still like it.
The Lego brick that you know was invented by a Danish carpenter and his son in the 1950s.
In Danish, playing well is called legot.
Legot was abbreviated to Lego.
Build hotels, animals, people, boats, skyscrapers, and more. So kids, get your Lego set now at department and toy stores everywhere.
And Lego took on a life outside the box, you could say. There have been life-size Lego houses, Lego cars. There's even an unsanctioned Lego Breaking Bad model set, meth-making materials not included. And several years ago, the little bricks caught the fancy of Adam Reed Tucker.
I'm actually talking to you right now from my studio at my workbench where I'm building this. I can give you a hint. It's I'm recreating Cinderella's castle for a Disney traveling exhibit that starts at the Museum of Science and Industry next week.
Tucker is one of a dozen certified Lego artists. That means he gets paid to play with Lego bricks. Post 9/11, though, he found himself out of work as an architect and still extremely affected by the destruction of the Twin Towers.
At the time, it was reported that the Empire State Building and the Sears Tower and other tall skyscrapers were not being visited as much because of that fear. And I wanted to do my little part to ensure the people that I could come across, you know, hey, don't be afraid of going up in the observatories. Don't be afraid of being a tenant in these buildings.
So what would be a good way to assuage fears and memorialize the Twin Towers? Why not build them out of a kid's toy? Now, it had been years since Tucker had even held a Lego brick in his hand.
So I literally went to a local Toys R Us one afternoon, and I filled up, I think, like 8 shopping carts of Lego sets and needed to get reacquainted with the brick to see what colors and elements, all that sort of thing. Obviously much different than, you know, when I was growing up in the late 70s.
And he built an 8-foot replica of the Twin Towers out of 26,000 bricks. The model is still traveling around the country, and it caught the attention of Lego. They commissioned an entire line of architectural wonders from around the world.
The Brandenburg Gate in Germany, of course, and Burj Khalifa, the Sydney Opera House, most recently the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
And now the United Nations headquarters. People have become obsessed with collecting and building these models. Why?
Just looking at a pile of parts and realizing anything is possible with that. But the flip side of that is knowing that if you do something and you want to change it, you can on the fly.
Perhaps that kind of innovation and flexibility might be a good model for UN policy as well. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucchi.
This young girl has such fun.
We had a little fun with Legos today. You can watch Nina and fellow producer Andrea Crossan attempting to construct the UN headquarters from the kit. That's all at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The film Captain Phillips opens today. It's based on the real-life tale of a container ship captain who was kidnapped by Somali pirates in 2009 and rescued by U.S. Navy SEALs.
Listen up. We have been boarded by armed pirates. Stay hidden at all costs. Don't want any hostages.
We will follow the procedures to lock down, go dead in the water, and wait for help.
Stick together. It will be all right.
That's Tom Hanks in the title role, but some say Somali-American Barkhad Abdi may be the real standout. Abdi plays the lead hijacker of the Maersk, Alabama. It was his first acting job. He says his childhood was a big help in understanding the character he plays.
Well, it helped me a lot. I was born in Somalia. I lived there for about 6 years, and I witnessed the war. Me and, you know, my mom and my 2 brothers and my sister.
And are there particular memories that you have of Mogadishu that you drew on for this role in Captain Phillips?
It's just the heartlessness, you know. It's like the people that came to attack Mogadishu, you know, they were just outside from human to me. I just understand, you know, my basic understanding of it, it's this guy, what he's been through, you know, I've been through that. I relate to this character because I was lucky enough to have parents that got me out of Somalia and took me from country to country. And I look at him as someone that did not have that chance. There was no country there. There was no hope. There's no schools. What he's doing is wrong. Me as a person, I believe, you know, you should, there's other ways to be somebody.
Now, I know the director of the film, Paul Greengrass, actually kept you and the other Somali-American actors apart from Tom Hanks, the big star, until your first confrontation on the bridge, until they filmed that scene. And we're going to hear a little bit from that scene where you and Tom Hanks, you and the Tom Hanks character, Captain Phillips, are meeting for the first time, both on screen and in real life.
Where is the crew?
I don't know.
You think we're playing? You think we're playing?
You're going to shoot somebody. Shoot me.
Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me. I'm the captain now.
1 minute, I kill all your friends. 1 minute.
That's a pretty tough scene. I want to ask first, do you think it was a good idea to keep you and Tom Hanks apart until that scene?
Absolutely. I think it was a great idea. And that idea made the film what it is now.
Why?
Because it built our character and it gives it that depth, you know, who we really are and, you know, how much we're so different from each other. And you know, the two characters. Because, you know, me and my friends, the main reason we came to do this auditioning, you know, it was because we love Tom Hanks. You know, that's one thing we all agreed on. We wanted to see Tom Hanks, you know, after that. So after we done training, we done some, you know, fighting and skiff training, and we even had to learn how to swim. So after we finished with all that, we went to see Tom, and Paul decided not to show us Tom. He said, you only see Tom when it's that scene you actually meet at the bridge.
That's a real challenge. Here, you can't wait to meet your hero, this actor who you adore. And the first time you meet him, you basically have to put him in this place and threaten him.
I had no choice.
You know, some of the wildest scenes in Captain Phillips is when you and the other Somalis, you're in this rickety junkyard skiff. You're being thrown around by these huge waves, and you're about to take over this giant container ship. And you're trying to hook your ladder onto this massive ship. It's pretty wild. I imagine, what was it like out there for you? Particularly, you hadn't known how to swim even before you made the movie.
Well, it was scary, you know. It wasn't all fun, but it was my friends, you know. We would have laugh right after the scene is finished. It was just a whole new experience for us. And I was truly fascinated by this whole pirates thing, you know, and how a small skiff taking over a big ship. Up close, you know, I was amazed by it, honestly. But, you know, we would fall here and there. But, you know, at the end of it, it was just, I have to do this. You know, I'm in it and, you know, I'll do the best I can.
Can you imagine a Hollywood movie where the Somalis are the good guys?
Well, Somalia do have the good and the bad, as well as America.
That's for sure. Somali-American Barkhad Abdi plays a leading role in the film Captain Phillips, which opens today. It's based on the real-life tale of container ship Captain Richard Phillips, who was kidnapped by Somali pirates. Thanks so much, Barkhad.
Thank you so much.
For many people around the world, this sound means one thing. The Doctor has arrived. Doctor Who. Starting this week, you can see some long-lost episodes of the BBC sci-fi series. The search for the missing reels took a TV archivist all the way to Africa's most populous country. What he found there is the talk of Doctor Who fans around the world. Here in our newsroom, not everyone knows the Doctor, but luckily we have intern Elizabeth Gillis to help fill us in.
Here's what happened. The archivist, Philip Morris, was rummaging around a storeroom of an old TV studio in Nigeria.
Just sitting on the shelf, which I can remember now, seeing a piece of masking tape that said Doctor Who on it. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Pull the cans down. I read the story codes and realized they were missing from the BBC's archive.
They were episodes no one had seen in about 46 years. In the 60s and 70s, the BBC distributed episodes of their dramas to many countries, including Nigeria. Those reels were duplicates. Later on, the BBC destroyed the original reels. The trouble was, the show was getting more popular. And it's still winning new fans. Doctor Who is now gaining ground in the United States, with its most recent run, which features the ninth actor to play the time-traveling hero. The tenth actor has already been cast. Some Americans may be surprised by the look of this episode from 1967.
There we are, that should work.
What's it do?
Oh, nothing.
Oh, no.
Well, nothing yet. But it will do once we start moving again.
Oh! Few people today have seen the early episodes of Doctor Who.
A lot of them were lost.
Much more of them were found in Nigeria, says David Donahue, a fan here in Boston. But he's encouraged by what was found.
I want to hope that this kindles an ongoing search because, I mean, how many more of these episodes are on some tape or some reel, just even unlabeled in a relay station somewhere in the world?
For lucky fans, archivists like Philip Morris are on the job. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Gillis.
That's it for us this week. Eric Goldberg composed our theme music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation, by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.